Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
Richard Martin here, again with another hour of Richard Martin's wake-up call. As I told you all on Thursday, I am not in town, I'm not at my desk, I don't have my full set of technology around me, so we're going to be winging this to a certain degree, but nevertheless, as I told you, I have an important talk for you today, and it concerns the credit derivatives market and the subprime situation, and it's going to be something of a turgid talk, so if you feel that you're not quite up to concentrating on a few more facts and figures than usual, I do suggest that you come back later on today when the archives are up and listen to it, when you can give it your full attention, because this is very important. And furthermore, I would say that if you really can get this, if you can understand the thrust of what I'm about to talk about, you will really understand how serious and grim this crisis is. And, of course, you'll be in a position to talk about it to other people, which does wonders for friendships and social interactions of one sort or another. But in the meantime, ladies and gentlemen, let's see if we can really crack this thing open and understand a little bit more in detail about how this nightmare has come to be. I've talked about the subprime crisis before, but I'm going to tackle it in a little bit of a different fashion today. Instead of just giving you definitions, I'm going to try to piece the pieces together to make some kind of a generalized picture that becomes clearer and more logical for you when you're really trying to understand the crisis, because believe me, it's extremely difficult to get this information from regular sources. So don't go thumbing through your local papers to see if you can get some kind of an enlargement on what I'm talking about here, because it's not going to happen. All right, let's go right into this. I wonder if it doesn't seem to you that with all that's been going on recently, it doesn't seem absurd if I make the case that this crisis is in fact just getting started. Think about, the approximately 45,000 homeowners losing their homes to foreclosure every month. You have the 8.9% plunge in nominal housing prices in 2007 alone. And that was the largest decline in over 20 years. Remember Bear Stearns losing 94% of the value of its stock in 2 days, with even the remaining 6% in value being based on an unprecedented loan from the Fed before J.P. Morgan would agree to the acquisition. So you might wonder how much worse it can actually get. Well, in order to understand the full extent of the danger, we need to move beyond the current headlines and take a brief but simple look at how these mortgage securitizations actually work. These securitizations are based on what are known as stress tests, or the ability of a security to withstand an adverse economic change and still pay principal and interest on schedule. The heart of the subprime problem is that no major stress tests happened in 2007, and the market still blew up. And this brings up the question of what will happen to subprime and other mortgage derivative securities in 2008 when actual stress tests do occur in such possible forms as recession, increase in interest rates, or a further plunge in housing values. Now, given that the safety margins have already been stripped bare, should just one of those stress tests occur, or worse, if two or three occur together, then quite frankly, we'll be looking back at 2007 as a mere stroll in the park in comparison. All right, well, to explain what I mean about nothing going wrong, let's review a bit of ancient history and talk about how ratings and securitized mortgages used to work. You started with a creditworthy borrower and a significant piece of equity invested in the property. The assessment of creditworthy was not a guess or an experiment, but rather the result of decades of underwriting experience on a national basis through good times and bad. With single-family mortgages, you had a large pool of such creditworthy borrowers, each having equity in their properties. Then you applied a stress test. A stress test is the assumption that something goes wrong. For instance, you might assume that there was a recession that would lead to homeowners losing their jobs and then their homes. If rising interest hurt the security, you would check out some rising interest rate scenarios. And if falling interest rates hurt the security, you would check out some falling interest rate scenarios. Essentially, you would push on the security until it fell over, using financial modeling. The rating was simply a description of how hard you had to push before the security fell over and one was unable to make a contractual principal and interest payments to investors. If the ability to make payments was a bit shaky under the current economic environment, then the rating was junk. If the ability to repay investors was pretty good with a decent economy, but possibly grew problematic with a mild recession, then maybe you got the lowest investment grade rating, that of BBB or BBB. The highest rating, AAA, was reserved for those securities that had such powerful coverage and reserves built into them that they could withstand another Great Depression and still make investor payments in full and on schedule. Or so the theory went until Wall Street got collectively brilliant a few years ago. All right, so to understand how the subprime debacle came about, we need to understand the reasons why supposedly prudent lenders would lend money to people wanting to buy houses who, unlike in our examples, had neither equity nor a good credit history. The essence of the theory is that you charge a high enough interest rate, then you can cover the losses and still walk away with more money than if you had been doing ye olde traditional and boring strategy of lending to creditworthy borrowers with actual equity in their homes. A simple version of the numbers is something like the way it was supposed to work as a theory. The theory was that if you lend to people who don't have particularly good credit and who didn't put much equity, if any, into their homes, then sure, foreclosures were going to happen, and at rates well in excess of national averages. In this case, for illustration purposes, there were many kinds of subprime mortgages securitized over the years. This is just one round number example. We assume that 8% of the mortgages go into foreclosure every year, and we assume that the loss per foreclosure is 30%, so there is an annual loss of 2.4% on a large pool of mortgages. If you were lending at the same low rates that a highly creditworthy borrower can get, then this 2.4% annual loss would be a bad thing. But if you are lending at a rate that is much higher than the market for good loans, and through securitization, you can get most of your funding at good loan rates, the 4.8% for AAA rates plus expenses, as in our example. Then that 2.4% annual loss is no big deal, and in fact leaves a lucrative amount of money for you and others to keep. In our example of how things were supposed to work, that 2.8% annual incentive with a $1.2 trillion market worked out to over $33 billion a year in incentives to securitize subprime mortgages. This was money that would be split many different ways. Mortgage banking fees, investment banking fees, high yields on junior classes for hedge funds and other aggressive investors, bond insurance payments, and some of the most lucrative rating agency fees, to assure investors that the whole thing would work, that have ever been seen in the capital markets. Multiply times 7 for an average mortgage life, and we're looking at almost $250 billion to be split, much of it just for massaging some numbers on a computer. That was the theory. But there proved to be some complications in practice. The sources of these problems were myriad, including underwriting people who could barely qualify for the teaser rate, while ignoring whether they could handle the full rate when the rate occurred, taking the thinnest of statistical histories and creating a huge new market from the selective interpretations that allowed the deals to get done, ignoring the due diligence reports if you didn't like them, and a number of other reasons that could all be summed up as the intersection of hubris and greed. The reasons are not our focus here, but suffice it to say that if it turns out that foreclosures are 15% instead of 8% for a particular grade of subprime, and foreclosure losses rise to 50% from 30% because so many people are getting foreclosed upon that it drives home prices downwards, then instead of splitting 2.8% of the excess profits in each mortgage pool, the big financial players are splitting a 2.3% loss, meaning $27 billion in annual losses instead of $33 billion in profits, which does not, by the way, purport to be an industry summary. While bad enough on its own, the losses showed that the securitization didn't work, the ratings didn't work, and the bond insurance might not work either, which then collapsed the prices in the market to a far greater extent than mere foreclosure losses to date would justify alone. The higher-than-expected losses did something else as well, something that truly made sophisticated investors nervous. Because the system failed with no genuine stress tests, and the layers of protection that were intended to insulate investors against adverse economic changes melted down, investors were left naked and exposed, vulnerable to any adverse changes. People in marginal economic circumstances tend to be the most vulnerable to recessions, and there are already a surplus of properties on the market. So, if we assume that a recession doubles subprime foreclosure rates from 15% to 30% and increases the loss per property from 50% to 60% as still more homes hit the market, by the way, banks lose far more money in a foreclosure than just the decline in overall property values would indicate, then, because we have no safety layers left, all the negative results go straight to the bottom line. Meaning that in our example, losses just went up by a factor of 5 with over $154 billion in losses in the first year. In other words, what we saw in 2007 was nothing compared to what 2008 will hold for investors. Recession, by the way, is not the only danger. We just experienced the highest levels of increases in prices in 17 years with an official annual CPI rate of 4.1% in 2007 and a 12-month PPI rate of 7.4% through January of 2008. Substantial inflationary dangers remain, and the Fed has effectively abandoned its already weak defense of the dollar in order to try to avert recession. So, recession pushed our losses up by 5 times in our recession illustration. What happens if, 1, a significant recession does hit, which looks more and more likely? 2, inflation does increase thanks to the Fed's recession-fighting efforts, meaning we now have stagflation. And 3, The drop in property values accelerates with the double whammy of people losing their jobs, even while mortgages grow less affordable in markets that are still falling. Or, if we want to look on an individual level, what happens to the chances of someone making their mortgage payments when, one, they lose their job, two, their mortgage payments more than double in 2 years since the initial teaser rate, and three, they owe $50,000 more on their mortgage than the market value of their home. Trouble can arrive in threes, and the triple whammy of recession, rising interest rates, and falling property values can indeed come ashore one after another, like three great tsunamis hitting a beach. Let's assume this three-way combination means that foreclosure rates triple from 15% to 45%, which, by the way, may be a bit conservative for subprime borrowers, none of whom ever really had the money for the home in the first place, under conventional lending standards. Let's further say that the glut of distressed homes on the market, even as unemployment is spiking upwards and mortgages are growing both less affordable and less available, means that the fall in property values accelerates and average investor foreclosure losses rise from 50% to 70%, just making those two reasonable changes to our assumptions means that subprime losses climb from $27 billion to $315 billion, an increase of almost 12 times. Should stagflation slam into an overpriced housing market after investor safety layers have already been stripped away, then we haven't even begun to see the full extent of the damage to investors, or to the housing market, and to the financial system as a whole. You know, these scenarios may seem overly optimistic, particularly when compared to such numbers as the $600 billion in industry losses which UBS is predicting, or the $160 billion in losses which they estimate to have already occurred. The reason for the discrepancy is that we have been sticking to just the mortgages and mortgage securities, and these securities are generally not bought with cash, rather they are bought with borrowed credit. Highly volatile, short-term borrowings, which carry major risks, all of their own. As an example, when Bear Stearns fell 94% in 2 weekend days, there was no change in the mortgage market that precipitated the fall. It was just the fear that Bear Stearns would lose their ability to borrow. An event that can make the capital of just about any seemingly solid-looking major bank or investment bank disappear in a flash. The bigger issue is that all the big financial players are highly leveraged. Now, just for round numbers, let's say that a big financial firm has $100 billion in assets, $94 billion in liabilities, and $6 billion in capital. We will assume that it owns $6 billion in questionable mortgage securities directly, with another $6 billion in loans to highly leveraged hedge funds that have their own questionable mortgage security holdings. Something drops the value of questionable mortgage securities by 25%. So the big financial firm takes a $1.5 billion hit directly and a 50% hit on the hedge fund loans when the hedge funds collapse and the creditors are left with illiquid and distressed collateral that they don't dare sell. The big financial firm just lost $4.5 billion, and the key number isn't that it lost 4.5% of the value of its assets, but that it had lost 75% of the value of its $6 billion capital base, with the remaining 25% being considered highly questionable. Meaning the financial firm now has to unload $75 billion in assets to maintain its 6% capital ratio, assuming it can survive at all, or else be recapitalized by a foreign investor, with the Fed possibly propping it up in the meantime when no one else will lend to it. In a market where everyone else has their own problems and don't have the money to buy the assets, this drops the prices of everything, which multiplies the losses upwards, which brings us to the real problem. If real subprime losses climb by 6 or 12 times, then system-wide financial losses likely climb by 24 times or 36 times or more. Because everything is linked, and the math that links all the dominoes is multiplication, not addition. If you want a mental picture of how banking dominoes work, don't think of one domino hitting another domino, hitting another domino in a long line. Rather, think of one domino hitting two dominoes, hitting four dominoes, and so forth. Understand this, and you will understand the desperation in the current moves by the Federal Reserve. So, will this disaster scenario that I've just outlined actually happen? Well, you know, we have to face some really inconvenient truths. The subprime market really did melt down in 2007. The so-called financial masters of the universe really did make some spectacularly stupid moves, really did nearly go broke and are having to turn to foreign investors and the Federal Reserve interventions in order to survive. Those rocks of stability and security in the financial system, the bond insurance firms and rating agencies, really did turn out to have foundations of sand rather than foundations of stone. Well, I think most people do agree that we really are entering a recession. Inflation really was at its highest level in 17 years in 2007, which could also easily turn into much higher interest rates. Housing values really are dropping in a number of major markets. The safety margins that protected subprime mortgage derivatives investors really did collapse, even without any major economic stress test, and up to three major stress tests may actually hit this already badly wounded market in 2008. Well, the scenarios are not exactly just technical, are they? Right, ladies and gentlemen, let me repeat yet again what I think you need to do in order to survive here. The first thing, as I've always said, is you need to cut your ownership of financial assets. The type of disaster scenario we are talking about will devastate stock and bond markets for a generation. Then you will never have the chance to replace your retirement on your portfolios, which have been taken down by this kind of scenario. The next thing you should very seriously think about is whether crisis leads to opportunities in ways that go well beyond a simple strategy of only buying the kind of assets we've talked about. There is a gentleman called John Paulson, who is no relation to Hank Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, by the way. And he saw the crisis that was coming in subprime mortgages. What did he do? He researched and educated himself on this area, which, by the way, had not been his field of expertise. And he turned the crisis into a $3 to $4 billion personal payday in 2007. If you're not a hedge fund manager like Paulson, you may not have the tools that he used to turn a market crisis into personal billions. Well, that's okay, because Paulson didn't start with the tools either. He started by educating himself, learning about a new area until he came up with a novel way to profit from disaster, a method that wasn't in the financial textbooks and that he didn't find by reading a financial columnist in the paper. Well, you know, you actually have more tools than you may think, some of which may surprise you. The kind of tools I'm talking about are those which can give you the opportunity to turn financial disaster into personal net worth. There are ways you can use those tools to turn the destruction of the currency into perhaps the greatest wealth-building opportunity of your life on a long-term basis. But if you want this to happen, you will need to start with learning. You are going to have to educate yourself, and not just understand, but master some of the financial forces and methods in play here. You will have to learn how to turn the destruction of paper wealth into real wealth. Okay, so before we carry on the next part of this, let me just give you my information really quickly. Again, my name is Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's wake-up call. The toll-free number here to the show is 888-873-4643. That is the number to call in at any point during the hour. I'll give it to you once more. It is 888-873-4643. If you would like to write an email, you can do that too. And the email address to which you should write in order to have your questions addressed here is rmartin@gscorporation.com. GS stands for Global Strategic, and that's where I work, Global Strategic Investments in Miami. The word corporation should be written out in full, please. And once again, it is rmartin@gscorporation.com. And finally, if you want to call me personally with your concerns and questions, you may also do so by calling 305-357-5575. Once more, 305-357-5575. All right. So I think what I'll do here is I will complete this presentation to you, and then I will take the questions at the end, and I will answer any email questions which have come up at that time. Okay? So we've talked about the subprime problem and how it can basically spread into the system without anybody really being able to identify the ways in which it's being done, but the knowledge that actually it is being done becomes clear to you from an extrapolation of the figures. Let's talk a bit now about the credit derivatives market, and that is much more serious in the long run because that's 30 times the size of the subprime mortgage market, and potentially actually even more at risk in the coming years. You know, so far we've explored the roots of the subprime crisis, demonstrated how mortgage securitizations work, and then used this knowledge to show why 2008 will be a much more dangerous year for the subprime mortgage markets and the global financial system than 2007. Well, now I'm going to show you how the same fundamental and quite human motivations that created the subprime market crisis also imperil the $35 trillion global credit derivatives market. So let's start by considering the simple heart of what credit derivatives are all about. Okay? A major investor has the opportunity to make an attractive-looking investment that involves taking a risk. For instance, a bank or insurance company sees an opportunity in lending to a corporation, but they are concerned about the financial safety of the corporation. They would prefer to keep most of the positive returns from the investment, but not take the risk of the company defaulting. So, as the employee of a company that creates financial derivatives, a credit swap in this case, what you do is promise, for a fee, to take the risk for them. Your company makes assumptions about how bad the risk will be, and based on those assumptions, you determine that this trade is profitable for your employer. You then personally take a nice chunk of those profits in your next bonus as a reward for having been smart enough to get your company into this lucrative transaction. And because this upfront booking of expected profits from these transactions is so lucrative, not only do you get an enhanced bonus, but so do the other members of your group, your supervisor, his or her supervisor, and the president and the other senior officers of the firm. Now, this is not to say that you and the other members of your group have entirely assumed the risk away. You make some allowance for the possibility that out of all these contracts that you're entering into, you may actually have to make some payments. To cover the possibility of losses, you set aside a reserve or buy a credit derivative from another company to cover, or both? The key to your bonus this year is the particulars of the assumptions that your group makes about what those expected losses will be in the future. The lower the assumption for expected losses, then either the greater your profits in a given transaction, or the more competitive your bid, and the greater your chances of beating out competitors who are seeking the same lucrative business. For example, if your firm is being paid $12 million to guarantee payment of a $500 million loan for 10 years, and your group assumes there is a 4% chance of having to pay out $250 million on that guarantee, then your expected losses are $10 million, and your firm's expected profit is $2 million. However, let's say that your group comes back and re-examines those assumptions. You find that if you make fairly minor and quite reasonable appearing changes to two of your assumptions, the potential loss of the derivative drops from an expected $250 million down to $225 million. Make two other minor changes in other assumptions that are also each individually reasonable, and the chances of that loss occurring drop from 4% down to 3.5%. If we rerun the numbers with a 3.5% chance of losing $225 million, your expected losses drop to $7.9 million, while your profits just doubled, going from $2 million to $4.1 million. Now, it quickly becomes clear to any reasonable person that if you can double the profits your firm recognizes on a transaction by keying in four small assumptions changes on a computer model, each of which sounds individually reasonable, and the end result of those changes is to double the bonus you get paid this year, then the key to making some serious personal money is nothing more than making the right assumptions. Something that is equally obvious to your peers at competitive firms. Ah, competition. Competition is where the process starts to get interesting over time. Competition for credit derivatives business for these easy profits means that you and others in your company have powerful personal incentives to make aggressive assumptions about how low credit losses will be and to validate your co-workers' assumptions as well. If your assumptions are not aggressive enough, you don't win any business. You don't earn bonuses. Your bosses don't earn bonuses. And you are quickly out of a job. The institutional culture then very quickly becomes that if you want to keep your job, you and the other members of your group make aggressive assumptions. If you want to make big bonuses, you make very aggressive assumptions about how low the losses will be on the credit derivatives, which then translates into increased business for you. And yes, other people will need to sign off on your group's assumptions, but they are in the same institutional culture as you are, with their own personal reward systems that are based on the company making money. Also keep in mind that even the internal, theoretical, watchdogs are put in place by senior management who have their own incentive structure which is based on the company making lots and lots of money this year. In a free market where all the employees and senior management of all the financial firms want their piece of this lucrative action, the first thing that happens is that the firms with aggressive assumptions keep the firms with conservative assumptions from getting any business. And then, because we have competition going on here, in the next stage of the cycle, the very aggressive assumptions firms take the business from the merely aggressive assumptions firms. Then, in the next cycle, the people making the very, very aggressive assumptions take the business away and the bonuses away from the merely very aggressive assumptions makers. To understand this process, you have to understand just how much money there is to be made by playing the game by its own rules, which may have very little to do with maximizing long-term shareholder value. Personal bonuses can be millions per year, with far higher payouts, by the way, for hedge fund managers. As an individual who is in the right place at the right time, you can make more money in one good year than a doctor or airline pilot will make in a career. Except that there is none of this medical school or being on call or flying over the Pacific Ocean business involved. There's just sitting at a desk and manipulating some numbers while working a phone. As a corporation, you can mint profits by the billions and tens of billions without going through that messy business of actually building things or selling toilet paper or drilling for oil in 2 miles of ocean and such and such. So, where does this take us? What happens when firms compete to make ever more aggressive assumptions in the pursuit of some of the most extraordinary profit levels in the history of business, in nearly unregulated markets? As it so happens, we have a pretty good case study that is still unfolding for us right now in a real-world derivatives market that is tiny in comparison to the overall credit derivatives market. In the case of the subprime mortgage derivatives market, by the time the very, very aggressive assumption makers had bested the very aggressive assumption makers, hundreds of billions of dollars of mortgage loans were being routinely extended to people. Four types of people, in fact. Those with poor credit histories of repaying their prior loans, those who put no equity into their homes, those whose self-reported and sometimes unverified incomes barely qualified at the initial teaser rate, and those who had no known means to come up with the additional money when the mortgage reset upwards from the teaser rate to the real rate. Of course, you don't need an MBA or a PhD in finance to understand the problems with those loans. Well, having said that, there are ways to make very good money through lending to subprime-type borrowers, but you need a way to deal with the foreclosure losses other than just assuming that the losses won't occur or that when the musical chairs ends and everyone sits down, it will be the other firms who are left standing. Because it just so happens that home buyers of limited means with bad credit and no savings often can't pay their mortgages when the payments skyrocket. And this leads to quite real losses that puncture all the levels of assumptions and risk passing. And these real losses do end having to be borne by investors after all, with implications that are still shaking the overall financial system. Sure, there were red flags everywhere, obvious, glaring, unmistakable warning signs. But no one really cared. Indeed, the investment banks were ignoring their own due diligence reports, because it was a party where enormous personal wealth was being earned and paid out in entirely real and spendable bonuses, so long as you played your role in the game aggressively, with no rewards for those who doubted. Eminently respectable senior executives from the most prestigious financial institutions in the world will, of course, strenuously object and insist they have very tight internal controls that makes this treatment ludicrous. The credit derivatives market is a complex place with a huge array of different types of derivatives, and there is more to the internal setups than I have time to describe today. That said, when you hear some eminently respectable senior executive on TV speaking of standard deviations and assuring you that you have nothing to worry about, just keep in mind that such assurances are being delivered buck naked, so to speak. the subprime crisis really is in process. The mistakes made were not black swans, but of the simple human greed variety. And as in the story, The Emperor's New Clothes, the lack of clothing is difficult to deny. We need to keep in mind that there is an important difference between the smallish subprime mortgage derivatives market and the much larger credit derivatives market. Mortgages are dirt simple in comparison to the complexities that are involved with corporate credit analysis. With a mortgage, you have a house. You should have a pretty good idea of the value of the house, or so lenders thought. You have an individual borrower with an income stream and a source for that income, and you have a credit history. Put all those together, and you have a reasonable idea about whether that individual can pay their loan and put 1,000 people like that in a pool, and you should have a very good idea about the likelihood of repayment. Yes, there are many complications in mortgage derivative structures, and all sorts of fun investor challenges with repayments and tranching and convexity and the like, but the underlying product is not all that difficult to understand. Corporate derivatives are an entirely different ballgame. With corporations, you need to assess complex financial structures. You need to look at the industry as a whole, assess the relative competitive standing of the company, look at foreign competition, examine comparative growth rates, subjectively evaluate management capabilities, and dive into the footnotes for clues as to pension and healthcare exposure, as well as including a wide array of other risks and factors. All of which require using assumptions. So, as I've already said, assumptions are where the money is made when it comes to derivative securities. When we compare the corporate credit derivatives market to the subprime mortgage derivatives market, there is far more room to make money through making aggressive assumptions with corporate derivatives. There are, in fact, a couple of credit derivatives assumptions that have the potential to dwarf the others. Let's start with the lesser of the two mega assumptions that have to be made, and that is, do you price for the possibility of a recession? You know your profits are going to be far, far higher if you don't include the possibility of recession. Indeed, it might be difficult to get business at all if you build the possibility of a serious recession into your credit derivatives pricing. And how much business can you get if you price for the chance of a recession but your competitor does not? Can you stay in the credit derivatives business at all? It is when we assume the possibility of a recession, let's say in 2008, that the situation truly becomes worrisome. As we saw with subprime mortgages, there are problems with taking profits based on assumptions when real losses can occur. If you're looking at $20, $50, or $200 billion in real losses on mortgage derivatives, then that money really needs to come out of the capital bases of the companies that have purchased the derivatives for profit. The entire financial system cannot successfully pass the risks off through ever more sophisticated financial modeling, until the risks have been assumed away altogether. Rather, the real losses really have to be borne by someone in the system, with real pain if the losses exceed the reserves. That is the basic common sense point that was being nearly universally ignored by the major financial firms in the subprime market. This basic principle is what is causing the decimation of the capital bases of such companies as Bear Stearns, Citibank, and Merrill Lynch, and they're needing to find additional investors. Now, here are my questions for you. Do you believe that such a financial system, one that refused to consider what would happen when a marginal home buyer inevitably had their rate reset within 1 year, would prudently pass up huge amounts of fee income in a far larger market to make sure that their corporate credit derivatives business could withstand the possibility, but not certainty, of a recession over the next few years? Which firm do you think would get the derivatives business? The one that charged whopping fees because they made conservative assumptions that fully priced in the next recession? or the equally prestigious world-famous firms that charged much lower fees by ignoring the possibility of recession? What do you think the individual employees did if incorporating recession assumptions meant getting no business and losing their job, whereas ignoring the possibility of recession led to promotions and multi-million dollar bonuses? Our second mega risk assessment is the truly dangerous one, and let me express it with two more questions for you, my esteemed and faithful listeners. Do you include in your wildest assumptions the possibility that every derivatives contract which you are underwriting is not independent, but may all go into a recession simultaneously? And what happens to the capital base of your employer at that point? All right, let's go back to our initial example of taking a $12 million fee for guaranteeing $500 million in corporate debt, where you think there is a 4% chance of losing $250 million. The idea, as with any insurance product, which is what credit derivatives essentially are, is that you sell that same guarantee on 500 companies, and you ultimately have to pay out on 20 of the 500 companies, which is 4%. You pay out $5 billion, but you take in $6 billion from the 500 fees of $12 million each, plus you get the investment earnings on the $6 billion until the payouts occur, so the whole business is, theoretically, lucratively profitable. Now, the problem is that this model assumes that each company is an independent risk, kind of like insuring 50 homes against the chance that an electrical fault will cause one house to burn. But what if the problem is not an electrical fire, but a wildfire burning out of control, and the homes you are insuring are on a bone-dry hillside in Southern California? The risks are no longer independent, and instead of losing on just one insurance contract, you lose on 20 out of the 50 contracts. The credit derivatives equivalent of the wildfire scenario is to imagine what happens if a recession hits the entire economy rather than just one company. Let's say that recession does hit. It's a bad one. And because you are guaranteeing the performance of 500 companies, all of whom already have financial issues during a time of semi-prosperity, the corporate equivalent of subprime, 200 of those companies fold instead of 20 during a time of financial turmoil. Because it turns out that the risk of failure is not truly independent after all. There is a correlation of risks during a major economic downturn. Now, at $350 million a shot, greater individual losses per incident, as we are in a recession, that is a $70 billion loss for your firm, which just went bankrupt, as did your firm's competitors. Since you and your competitors can't pay your claims, those companies who relied on your $70 billion in claims paying off, and your four largest competitors, $280 billion in claims, find out they are not going to get paid, which means they have to take the total $350 billion in losses, which they can't withstand either. So down the tubes they go, followed by the companies behind them as the titans of the financial world turn into falling dominoes. Hey, if you want to understand why the Fed consistently and aggressively intervenes at the first sign of derivative troubles, that is why. All right, look, I've been trying to keep things very simple and basic. But the issues associated with correlation and systematic risk are at the heart of the most sophisticated financial concerns about whether credit derivatives decrease financial risk or increase financial risk for the entire financial system. One key issue is, how can you properly reserve for a potential $70 billion loss when you are collecting only $6 billion in fees? The simple answer is, you can't. The only way you could do so would be to drastically increase your fees and transfer most of the risk to other parties, which would price you out of the marketplace. So in practice, all the pricing for systematic risk does is to remove you from the business, as you can't compete with firms that aren't pricing in for correlated risk. Even if you could get the pricing to work, however, there is a more fundamental limitation. Let's say you had no competition, and you could double your fees, and you used the extra $6 billion to buy credit derivatives for your credit derivatives portfolio from another firm, so that any losses above $5 billion were covered by them, assuming your firm could handle the first $5 billion in losses. Now we assume again there is a vicious recession. Your losses reach $70 billion. You take the first $5 billion in hits. Then you go to your counterparty for the rest of the $65 billion. And from exactly where do they come up with $65 billion? Ladies and gentlemen, this goes to the core of the derivatives dilemma. Everyone can make all the assumptions they want and merrily pass the risk along to the next counterparty and book their profits and bonuses for so long as the music lasts. But what happens when the music stops? What happens when return once more gives way to risk, as has happened time and again in the financial world? We have an example right in front of us, right now, with the subprime mortgage debacle. And despite everyone having assumed that they had passed the risk along when the music stopped, the risks were real and the losses actually had to be borne. Indeed, we unfortunately have two very good examples of what happens when systematic correlated risks meet credit derivatives when it comes to MBIA and AMBAC. Until recently, these two bond insurance companies were bulletproof financial titans with the unquestioned gold-plated AAA ratings to prove it. Armed with ample layers of capital, these two firms could by themselves essentially protect the creditworthiness of the entire nation against recession and even depression. On paper, according to assumptions used by the rating agencies and the rest of the financial system. Then, in the real world, they actually ran into correlated risks in one obscure corner of their overall portfolios of guarantees, when it turned out that if too many subprime borrowers started to default at the same time, it depressed housing values, which turned out quite predictably to increase foreclosure rates while simultaneously increasing losses per foreclosure. Now, so long as the risks are independent, then MBIA and AMBAC could easily have shrugged off increased losses in a few securities or even a few dozen securities. But with correlated risks hitting tens and hundreds of billions of dollars of securities simultaneously, the bulletproof capital base for a AAA-rated insurance giant can turn into vapor in a matter of months. Something that the market has already incorporated into the pricing of these firms' stocks and debt, even while the rating agencies maintain their ridiculous AAA facade to keep domino effects from imperiling the municipal bond and other markets. Now, here's the thing. The subprime mortgage market is tiny compared to the overall corporate market, a corporate market which has credit derivatives interwoven throughout. Let's say in this day of highly leveraged companies that a real recession does hit and it takes down something like $2 or $5 trillion worth of book value along with it. Those would be real losses, staggering losses that dwarf what we have seen with the subprime mortgages. Where is the money going to come from to pay for those losses? In theory, the way this works from an academic economics perspective is that you have all these hordes of incredibly intelligent busybodies, each of whom is working for well-capitalized institutions, and they all backstop each other. They do so first by using that supposedly awesome collective intelligence that keeps mistakes from being made in the first place. Next, the theory is that there will be multiple layers of protection available if there's a problem to absorb any damage. Unfortunately, what we actually saw happen in the real world with mortgage derivatives was just the reverse of the theory. The multiple layers of the so-called smartest person in the room became multiple layers of people making steadily worse and more obvious mistakes in the pursuit of short-term profits until the situation not just predictably, but inevitably collapsed upon them. On top of that, far from the firms backstopping each other, in the real world we have a cascading series of credit losses that spread from one firm to another as tens of billions of dollars in actual subprime losses multiplied out to become much larger hits to values of securities portfolios, nearly bringing down the industry together. Which again brings up the question of what happens if a real recession, hits the $35 trillion credit derivatives market. Two monumental events have occurred this month. An all-time record $772 billion of corporate debt is being placed on credit watch in the second quarter of 2008 for a possible downgrade. And the AAA ratings of both bond insurance companies, MBIA and AmBank, have been downgraded. If we simply add the two together, the $772 billion in corporate debt in danger of imminent downgrade and the more than $1 trillion in AAA debt insured by MBIA and AmBank that have also lost their AAA ratings, that is a total of $1.7 trillion, ladies and gentlemen, which is almost 150% the size of the entire $1.2 trillion subprime mortgage derivatives market. With all those potential downgrades coming in just one day, troubles in credit derivatives market are real. They are coming on fast. And if things go bad in a major way, they will make the subprime crisis look minuscule in comparison. Which then leads to the question, which dominoes or prestigial financial firms awoke to another $1.7 trillion in bad news today? How bad a morning are they having? Who will be left standing when the music stops this time? Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your time. I look forward to talking to you again on Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Bye-bye for now.